astounding, for this was no usual test drive, and theirs was no typical passenger. Seated in one of the plush leather seats in the back of the cabin was Mustafa al-Hassani. The 75-year-old Iraqi president had said nothing to the pilots on the 6-hour round trip to Samarra and Karbala and back. Most of the flights he had spent talking on a satellite phone or with his chief political aide, Khalid Tariq. The men flying the helicopter were somewhat in awe, being in the presence of one of the few Arab leaders who had actually survived the firestorm, and they were dying to ask how he had done it. What did al-Hassani know that the others didn't? Was he a god, as the buzz on the Arab street now claimed? He certainly looked like a holy man, with intense dark eyes, a long weathered face, a salt-and-pepper beard, and white flowing robes, and few seemed to doubt he had a spark of the divine. Widely considered the intellectual grandfather of Iraq's pro-freedom movement, he had once been a beloved professor of Arabic literature and poetry by day, and one of the country's shrewdest political strategists and revolutionary organizers by night. He had conceived a vision of what Iraq could be without Saddam, back when few thought it was possible, and he had vowed not to rest until he helped bring it to pass. It had gotten him arrested and imprisoned by the Ba'ath Party, and he had been tortured without mercy. But now, here he was, sitting behind them, a man who seemingly could not die. The Iraqi-born but American-trained chopper pilots desperately wanted to talk with this rising icon. They wanted to hear his stories and ask him questions, not just about how he was enjoying his ride, but about his plans for the future. But they knew it was a line they could not cross. Their job was to fly, not to speak, and they could not afford to be fired. So they simply chose to be content with being in al-Hassani's presence. What was particularly intriguing to them was the fact that political, business, and tribal leaders from all over the region were suddenly converging upon Babylon for a series of apparently top-secret meetings. The pilots themselves had been required to sign non-disclosure forms covering all of their time with the Iraqi president. Moreover, they had heard no specific names mentioned over their radios, but it was clear from the chatter of the air traffic controllers that these leaders were coming from as far away as Algeria to the west and Kyrgyzstan to the east. They had even overheard a flight originating from Isfahan, Iran, being cleared into Iraqi airspace less than an hour ago. But why? What could possibly bring them all to Babylon amid all the horror going on in their own countries? Viggo Mariano took the call on the balcony.
"Is it finished?" he asked.
"Almost."
"What's it taking so long?"
"There are complications."
"What kind of complications?"
"None, I'm afraid, we can talk about by phone."
Mariano seriously doubted that. Both he and the man on the other end of the connection were on secure satellite phones, unlisted, untraceable, and swept for bugs, as were their homes and offices, twice a week. But at this point, there was no reason to take more chances than absolutely necessary.
"How many are done?"
"3.
"That's it?" Mariano sniffed, pacing obsessively and all but oblivious to the stunning views his 2,200-square-foot penthouse suite at the Rome Cavalieri Hilton afforded him.
"Like I said, there have been complications."
"What about the old man?"
"My team is in a place. I just talked to them."
"Is he back in the country yet?"
"He lands in a few hours."
"He'll go through VIP service, right?"
"Every time."
"So when will you have a clear shot?"
"Highway 1, a few miles before his driver gets to the city limits."
"What about his security detail?" Mariano asked.
"He dropped it."
"When?"
"Last week."
"Why?"
"How should I know? All I know is that this is his first trip without the guards, without his bulletproof SUV, without a tail car. It's just an old Volvo and a kid driver who can't be more than 25. Look, I've got another call coming in. It's them."
"When will I hear from you next?"
"When you hear the news break, wire the money to my account. I'll call you when it clears."
"Fine. But listen to me, Rossetti."
"I understand, sir."
"This thing's coming from the top." and I...
Don't worry, I got it.
You'd better, thought Mariano, but he said no more. He just clicked off the phone, tossed it onto the lounge chair, and poured himself another glass of wine. He looked out over the sprawling ancient city at the dome of St. Peter's Basilica, practically glowing in the distance, and calculated his next moves. Time was running out. If he was to be paid in full, all of the targets had to be dead by sundown on the 20th. That was just 8 days away, and they were only halfway through the list. Chapter 8. Monday, January 12th, 4:02 p.m., Ronda, Spain. It didn't take long to fall in love with Ronda. One of the last Moorish cities to fall to the Crusaders, and one of the oldest towns in Spain, it was a hidden paradise of rolling hills, dazzling sunsets, fields and mountains as far as the eye could see, and a 200-year-old stone bridge spanning a breathtaking, plunging river gorge in the center of town. No wonder this sleepy little town tucked away so far from civilization had captured Erin's imagination as a little girl. No wonder it had drawn her back more than 2 decades later. It was off-season and a bit chilly, but the Bennetts had spent a lazy morning strolling Ronda's streets, visiting the ancient Arab baths, and touring the bullfighting arena known as the Plaza de Toros, which was built in 1784 and still held crowds of thousands in the crowded summer season. By afternoon, they were poking through various shops, looking for nothing in particular, and letting their imaginations run free. "What are you thinking about, Mr. Bennett?" Erin asked as they ducked into a cafe and ordered cappuccinos. "Nothing," he laughed. "Come on, what is it?" "No, no, let's talk about you," he said. "Where would you like to go to dinner?" "Nice try, but you have to tell me. Those are the rules, remember?" She sweetened the deal with a kiss. "It's nothing, really," he said finally. "I was just thinking about what I'd like to do if time and money were no objects." "And?" Bennett wasn't used to daydreaming about any life other than the one he'd had on Wall Street for almost a decade and a half. Moreover, this idea seemed downright ludicrous, particularly in light of recent events. But it seemed fun and somehow comforting to have a blue sky session with his best friend. "It's crazy, I know, but if Mordecai were wrong about all that's ahead, and if we could really do whatever we wanted, I would love to pull together some investors, buy a huge tract of land in Northern Virginia, and build an exact replica of the White House and old executive office building, to scale."
"I beg your pardon?" asked Erin.
"Think about it," he said, his eyes wide with childlike delight. "What's the number one place visitors from all over the country and all over the world say they want to see when they come to Washington?"
"The White House."
"Exactly. But with all the security restrictions, hardly anyone gets in anymore. And even if they do, they never get to see the West Wing or the Oval Office or the really fun stuff. But what if they could? What if there was a White House people could really explore? A White House where they could actually be invited to a state dinner?"
Erin was smiling, but it was clear she wasn't completely following.
"Imagine if there was a White House where families could take real insider tours every weekday. But every Friday and Saturday night, there'd be a state dinner. Black tie, formal gowns, big celebrities, the whole nine yards. You'd call an 800 number and make a reservation, and you'd be told to arrive at the visitor's center at 7 p.m. sharp."
"Visitor's center?" asked Erin.
"Exactly," said Bennett. "You'd park there, 2 or 3 miles away from our White House Resort and Conference Center. And you'd be assigned a position on a covered platform, sort of like at a train station, heated in the winters and cooled in the summers. You'd have to be there no later than 7, because at precisely 7:15 the real adventure begins. A presidential motorcade suddenly comes up over a ridge, lights flashing, sirens wailing. There are motorcycles, police cars, a fleet of black limousines with little American flags waving on the hoods, all followed by black Suburbans and more motorcycles. The limos pull up, and you're assisted inside by ushers and security people, dressed up as Secret Service agents. Then the doors close, and the motorcade begins the 2 to 3 mile drive through the Virginia countryside, until you come up over a hill, and there it is. Bigger than life, awash in big floodlights."
Erin looked more interested now.
"And as you arrive, the big black gates open, and you're brought around to the driveway on the south lawn.
If you're in the first set of limousines, you're immediately escorted to a tour of the West Wing. If you're in the middle set, you get a guided insider tour of the East Wing and the secret underground facilities, like the sit room and the Secret Service Command Center, that kind of thing. If you're in the last set, you get to tour the main floors of the White House, the Lincoln bedroom, the private residence, the solarium, all the private stuff the public usually never gets to see. Then, at precisely 8:15 p.m., you're seated for an elegant dinner of filet mignon and lobster and the finest champagne, followed by a famous speaker or comedian. On some nights, we'd have charitable concerts hosted by the First Lady or by former First Ladies. On other nights, we'd bring in Dana Carvey or Will Ferrell to do a night of presidential comedy. Some nights could simply be ballroom dancing. The possibilities are endless. We could even host a weekend global issues summit with former presidents or secretaries of state. Think about it. Easter egg rolls where no kid is turned away. White House Christmas parties every night of December that everyone can attend. Inaugural balls, helicopter rides over Washington in our own versions of Marine One. We could even rent out the Lincoln bedroom and it wouldn't be illegal. Erin couldn't help but laugh. For all the years she had known John Bennett, on Wall Street and in the White House, he had always been so serious, so focused, so consumed with cutting deals and bringing peace and democracy to the Middle East. She had never seen him with the time or the desire to dream such crazy dreams. She loved him all the more for it, but she still had to rib him a little at least. "And this is what you think about in your spare time?" she asked. "You have no idea."
"Dr. Mordecai?" said a stranger's voice. "Is that really you?"
Mordecai pulled his head out of the stack of emails he was reading, looked up at the passport control officer, and handed over his passport.
"I'm afraid so," he said at last. "I'm sorry, do I know you?"
"No, but I thought it was you," the young woman replied. "What an honor."
He waited for the punchline, but there was none. The officer seemed genuinely glad to meet him, and he couldn't help but be surprised. Most Israelis now considered Mordecai, the world's most famous messianic Jew, a heretic, if not an outright traitor. The country's chief rabbis were pressuring Prime Minister Daron to strip Mordecai of his citizenship, claiming he had converted to Christianity and thus had renounced his Jewishness. Death threats against him were mounting. He had been cursed and spat upon. He had even been physically attacked on the streets of Jerusalem, as well as in the airport. So to be greeted so warmly upon returning to his country was certainly serendipitous. The young woman stamped his passport for re-entry without going through the usual list of security and customs questions, then lowered her voice.
"The Lord is risen," she said.
Again, Mordecai was taken aback.
"He is risen indeed," he whispered in return. "How long have you been a follower of Yeshua?"
"Almost 3 months," she said. "I kept seeing you on TV before everything happened. I read your memo on the internet. At first I thought you were a lunatic, but then everything happened just like you predicted."
"Just as Ezekiel predicted," Mordecai gently corrected.
"Yes, of course," the young woman conceded, still in a whisper. "Anyway, I just wanted to say thank you. I know it hasn't been easy for you, but most of my family now believes as I do. Not my father. He thinks we're all nuts, but we're praying for him night and day, just like you tell us to do."
The woman had tears in her eyes, and Mordecai found himself moved by the passion of her new faith. Thousands of people had posted similar thank yous on his weblog, while many others posted curses. But this was the first Israeli he had met with the courage to thank him face to face, and it meant more to him than he could possibly tell her.
"Don't forget Psalm 122, verse 6. Keep praying for the peace of Jerusalem," he told her. "And I'll be praying for your father."
"Thank you, Dr. Mordecai," she said. "Thank you so much."
"You're most welcome," he replied. "You've made an old man's day. God bless you."
He then scooped up his briefcase and bags and headed out front to find his driver. Chapter 9. Monday, January 12th, 7:15 p.m., Babylon, Iraq. Security was tight around the Great Tower of the People. Outside, Dark clouds were rolling in, and a cool breeze was picking up. The winter rains were coming, and the temperature, now hovering in the low 60s, would soon plummet. Inside the luxuriously appointed and newly completed Iraqi capital, the National Assembly speaker called for order. One by one, all 434 men and 16 women, some in finely tailored suits from London and Paris and New York, others in the traditional robes of the Arab sheikhs, took their seats and grew quiet, eager to understand why they had been summoned on such short notice and with such secrecy.
Members of Parliament and distinguished guests and neighbors, I realize many of you have come a great distance at your own personal expense, and with very little notice. It is my honor to welcome you to the city of Babylon, the speaker began to polite applause. On behalf of our president and our people, I want to thank you personally for joining us for what I believe will prove to be a most historic event. For most of you, this is your first time inside the walls of this great city. We hope it will not be your last. Indeed, we will do everything we can to make your stay here as enjoyable as possible. Please do not hesitate to ask if there is anything you need. For many years, as you know, Baghdad was our capital, but as you can see, it is no longer. Why, you may ask? It is a reasonable question, and there is a simple answer. Baghdad, my friends, was Saddam's capital, the capital of a past we wish to forget. Babylon, on the other hand, is our future, not just mine or my colleagues, but yours as well. President al-Hassani and I firmly believe that together we can build something great, something enduring, something that will cause the whole world to stop and take notice, and this is why you have been invited here tonight.
From his seat, Mustafa al-Hassani looked out over the packed chamber. It was being used for the very first time, and even though he had approved every detail in the design phase, now that it was finished, he could not help but admire its marble pillars and crystal chandeliers and handsome mahogany desks. It was the perfect venue for this decisive event. He scanned the crowd, taking special care to make eye contact with each and every one of the 50 VIPs who had accepted his personal invitation, assembled from across North Africa, the Middle East, Turkey, and the former Soviet Union. They were not heads of state, of course, for most of those had perished in the firestorm. But they were men and women of great respect and influence, a potpourri of ministers and deputy ministers and tribal leaders and CEOs who happened to have had the good fortune of being far from their capitals when the tragedy struck. Now their countrymen back home were looking to them to rebuild their devastated nation-states as they struggled to comprehend the loss of family members, friends, and business and political allies. But the question looming large over the heads of all those now assembled was, where and how could they begin? As he surveyed the audience, al-Hassani was a cauldron of mixed emotions. In many ways, he, like them, was still in shock. Tehran and Moscow were all but gone. So were Riyadh, Kuwait City, and Tripoli, and cities such as Beirut, Tunis, Ankara, and Tashkent had fared little better. Aside from Babylon itself, only Cairo, Amman, and Rabat seemed to have been spared the magnitude of destruction the other major Middle Eastern Islamic capitals had faced. Yet at the same time, al-Hassani privately found himself relishing the apocalyptic turn of events. In one single, horrifying, history-altering day, the leaders and military forces of all of his enemies, save the Israelis, had been wiped off the face of the earth. For the moment, he didn't know how or why, nor did he care. All he knew for sure was that his initial assessment was as true today as it had been 3 months earlier. He had been given a gift, an opportunity unparalleled perhaps since the days of the great Babylonian king Nebuchadnezzar. The ancient empire of his ancestors had once stretched from the mountains of Iran in the east to the western deserts of Egypt, from Saudi Arabia in the south to Georgia and lower Russia in the north. And now, events were conspiring in his favor to rebuild it. Who could now prevent him from consolidating his control over the same territory, a vast and wealthy region of more than 500 million people and 2/3 of the world's known energy supplies? The Americans? The EU or the Chinese? Not likely. They all saw him as an ally, not an enemy. Indeed, If he played his cards shrewdly, the U.S., the EU, and the entire United Nations would soon all but beg him to take this enormous burden off their shoulders. After all, it was one thing to nation-build in some poor, war-torn, despotic African jungle. It was quite another to rebuild the economic and political infrastructure of a region as vital to the global economy as the oil-rich Middle East. Who else was going to do it? Iraq was the only major OPEC member left standing. The industrialized world was desperate to get oil flowing out of Saudi Arabia, Iran, the Gulf, and the Caspian Sea once again. And with the price of oil north of $200 a barrel since the day of devastation, hundreds of billions of dollars were already pouring into Iraqi coffers. Soon trillions would be. Why not offer the world Iraq's help in rebuilding the drilling, pumping, and refining facilities throughout the region needed to bring sanity back to global energy prices? For a small price, of course. Chapter 10. Monday, January 12th, 7:32 p.m., Babylon, Iraq. Al-Hassani suddenly heard his name echo through the hall. He saw the gathering of dignitaries rise to give him a standing ovation. How far he had come, he now realized, further than he had ever imagined, and it was as intoxicating as it was surreal. He basked for a few moments in the warmth of his colleague's affection, then slowly rose and made his way to the podium to share his vision with a people perishing without one. Without the aid of notes, he greeted each of the visiting VIPs by name and expressed his condolences for their losses. And then he said,
"The Iraqi people share in your suffering. We have seen the horror that has been inflicted upon you. We have heard the cries of the suffering. We have responded as quickly as we could, but this is only the beginning. You have my word and that of the people of Iraq. We will move heaven and earth to help you recover and rebuild. You will not be left alone."
The crowd erupted with applause, but Al-Hassani barreled on.
"No nation on the face of the earth, not the Americans nor any of the Europeans, have done as much as the Republic of Iraq to bring bread to the hungry, water to the thirsty, clothes to the naked, shelter to the homeless, and medical assistance to all those in pain. We have already paid out more than $500 million in humanitarian aid and emergency relief, but it is not enough. I would like to announce right now that the people of Iraq pledge $1 billion more, and we will double it again if need be, because you are our brothers and sisters, and we must stand together in this critical hour."
The entire assembly was now on their feet again. There were tears in the eyes of many.
"We deserve no credit," Al-Hassani demurred. "We are merely repaying a great debt. You came to our side in our moment of need. You helped us get back on our feet after a devastating war and a brutal insurgency, and for this the Iraqi nation will always be grateful. Baghdad may have been the epicenter of evil, but Babylon will be the house of compassion, hospitality, and unity among the peoples of North Africa and the Middle East."
Once again, the hall erupted. The standing ovation lasted for several minutes, and Al-Hassani stepped back from the podium and lowered his head, overcome with emotion. When the crowd quieted and sat back down, he continued.
"A great terror has befallen us, my friends. Some call it the day of devastation. Some say it was the judgment of God, but this cannot be true. How can it be? How could any God be so cruel, so vengeful? Regardless, the deed is done. It has changed our region and forever changed our hearts. Of this there can be no doubt. The question is not whether we will be changed, but how. Will we be defeated and divided, or inspired and united? In the last 3 months, we have seen an outpouring of concern and care from the four corners of the earth. Beyond what has been provided by the people of Iraq, other nations have pledged enormous sums in relief assistance, and more is coming. But do not be deceived, my brothers and sisters. Such aid comes with strings attached."
A hush began to settle over the great hall.
"In the last century, The British and the French and the Americans carved up our region, and we did nothing,
al-Hassani continued.
We sat back and let it happen. We let them draw artificial boundary lines to create our borders. We let them exploit our resources without just compensation. Cash, yes, they gave us cash for our oil, but what about our freedom? What about our right to govern ourselves and shape our own destinies? Were we not too quick to give up what was rightfully ours for mere trinkets from the West? And now we have come to another critical juncture in the history of our people. What will we do? How will our children and grandchildren judge us? How will they remember us? Will we sit back and let Washington and London and Brussels and the UN Security Council claim to have bought the privilege to draw new maps simply because we have accepted their aid packages? Is this the best for which we can hope? I realize full well that you and the people you represent have had precious little time to think of such things. You and your colleagues have been consumed with thoughts of survival, which is only right and proper. But know this, larger questions are coming. The future of our entire region is at stake, and the imperialists are already sharpening their carving knives. Of this you can be certain. At the moment, those of you from the devastated nations have little or no political power, clout, or leverage. Most of you have no formal governments, elected or appointed. You have no capital cities. You have no militaries, nor the national treasuries with which to rebuild them. Your ambassadors have no instructions, no idea to whom they should report, and rapidly dwindling funds with which to operate. For all intents and purposes, you are occupied by U.S. and EU and UN military forces cloaked in the disguise of humanitarian workers. How long can this last? Before you all once again become colonies of the West. Your only hope of resisting long-term Western occupation is to rapidly rebuild your oil and gas industries as we in Iraq have done. But how are you supposed to accomplish this urgent task without desperately needed infusions of capital, large amounts of capital? And how can you raise capital if the banks are loath to lend you money? This, my friends, is a hard, cruel reality, and it leaves you dangerously vulnerable to the very imperialist forces you have long sought to resist. Distinguished colleagues, I submit that the only way we can survive is if we unify. Only if we combine our economic and political resources will our region ever be able to get back on its feet and give dignity to our people. We Iraqis have done it. After a long, hard struggle, we have come together as one. Imperfectly, I concede, but who can argue that out of the ashes of war and insurgency and despair, a new Iraq has emerged as one nation, with one voice? Sunnis and Shiites, Arabs and Kurds, north and southeast and west, able to defeat the forces of evil within and the forces of imperialism without. Let this be a model for all. Unity must be our aim. We cannot rebuild if we allow ancient passions and prejudices to divide us. We cannot achieve our destiny if we allow the Western powers to divide and conquer us. So I put these questions to you today. What if we seize the initiative and take our future into our own hands? What if a year from now there was a great power to rival the United States of America and the United States of Europe? What if there arose a single new nation, a single new economic and political force encompassing the great peoples of Southern Europe, the Mediterranean Basin, North Africa, the Middle East, and the former Soviet republics of Central Asia? Perhaps it would be known as the United States of Eurasia, or perhaps the Republic of Namastan, or perhaps something else altogether. It is not a name to which I am wed. It is a single vision by which I am driven, a vision of one people, one government, one currency, one unified force with which the rest of the world must reckon. And I ask you tonight, who among you will share my vision?
Chapter 11. Monday, January 12th, 8:05 p.m. Highway 1 to Jerusalem.
Tripwire to Dagger.
Dagger, go.
I've got a visual on the car. He's coming your way.
Who's with him?
Just the driver.
Anyone else?
Negative. You should have a clear shot.
Roger that. Dagger to Wolfpack. 6 minutes. Mordecai hung up the phone and stared out his window. Row upon row of oil wells blurred by as his car raced up Highway 1, trying to get him into Jerusalem in time for a BBC television interview, scheduled just 25 minutes from now. Depending on traffic, they might just make it, thought Mordecai, but he wasn't worried. He had done more interviews than he could count since the Ezekiel Option memo had been splashed across the pages of the world's newspapers. Dozens of new requests came in every day. He couldn't possibly do them all. Interest in his perspective on world events was growing exponentially. His weblog registered upward of 6 and even 7 million hits a day, and he was having trouble finding an ISP that was both willing and able to handle the actual volume, which several computer technicians estimated at north of 15 million hits a day. He leaned back in his seat and wondered what he would write about when he got home. He had already written extensively about the bombing in Washington on his flight home and uploaded all that at the airport. He couldn't write about John and Aaron's wedding, of course. They hardly needed more publicity. But the truth was, that beautiful ceremony was what he was thinking about most. Mordecai had particularly enjoyed his conversation with Ken Costello and his wife Tracy just before the service had begun. They had been intrigued by his memo and fascinated with his theory, but they still weren't sure they bought his conclusions. By their own admission, they had been agnostics before the world had taken a turn for the worse, lapsed Catholics, in their words, whose trips to church in the past had been on Easter and Christmas, but rarely in between. Now they were searching for answers and attending a Bible church in Bethesda, Maryland. Mordecai had no doubt they would discover the truth. He just hoped it was in time.
Dagger, this is a periscope. Over.
Go ahead, periscope.
We have eyes on the target. Just hit some traffic, slowing a bit, but still headed your way.
Roger that. All units, stand by. Something extraordinary was underway. In Ezekiel 38 and 39, the God of Israel had declared, "I will magnify myself, sanctify myself, and make myself known in the sight of many nations, and they will know that I am the Lord. And I will not hide my face from them any longer, for I will have poured out my spirit on the house of Israel." And sure enough, these ancient prophecies were coming to pass. Never in history had so many Jews and Gentiles declared themselves followers of Jesus Christ. Every day, Mordecai received emails with news from around the globe that made him literally weep with joy. Churches and messianic Jewish congregations were exploding in numbers. The term small group Bible studies was quickly becoming extinct from the evangelical lexicon. Nothing was small anymore. Once deserted cathedrals throughout Europe were filled to capacity. Tiny country churches in rural America were having enormous camp meetings in cornfields. Thousands of Buddhist and Hindu temples in India, Pakistan, and Southeast Asia were being converted into Bible churches. In Korea and Japan and throughout the Pacific Rim, millions of new believers were meeting for worship in soccer stadiums. Perhaps most extraordinary was word of hundreds of new Bible-believing, Bible-preaching congregations springing up throughout the Middle East, as well as news that once clandestine house churches and underground gatherings of believers were now coming out into the warm Mediterranean sunshine. Muslims were turning to Christ in record numbers, and Mordecai could only shake his head to see former mullahs and imams on Al Jazeera and other regional television and radio shows now preaching the gospel like modern-day apostles. He wanted to go and see it all for himself, firsthand. He wanted to visit the people, the homes, the rapidly growing assemblies of new believers in Libya and Sudan, and especially Iran. He had received invitations from all over the region, from believers eager to hear his teaching after reading his words online. But time was running out. The Lord was coming back soon. How could he best invest his time until the end? Mordecai scrolled through his trio for new emails. As he did, He came across one from the pastor of Christ Our Shepherd Church, now the largest and fastest-growing congregation of Muslim converts to Christ on the Arabian Peninsula. Dear Brother Mordecai, greetings from Mecca, where Jesus is now the King. Thank you so much for your very encouraging note, and even more important, for your unceasing prayers. I write to you with good news of great joy, an update on how our risen Savior is blessing our little congregation. Over the past 30 days, we have had the privilege of baptizing another 2,206 members, bringing the total followers of Jesus in our community to just over 14,000. We face great hardships here. As the shock of the earthquake and firestorm begins to lessen slightly, persecution is intensifying, but not from Muslims. Indeed, there are few true followers of Muhammad anymore. Most Saudis are experiencing great confusion over what they believe and where to go next. They have seen their God shattered, like the prophets of Baal, and now they are searching for the truth and asking us many questions. We can barely keep up. That said, the trials we face today come mostly from the UN peacekeeping forces, who recently arrived to keep order. They have shut down our church's food and clothing distribution efforts to families in need and are accusing us of trying to bribe people into our faith. They have denied us a building permit as well, refusing to let us build a church amid the ashes of the destroyed mosques. But we have not lost our joy. May it never be. We will persevere by His grace. Would you pray about coming to preach to us, to encourage us, and help us choose and anoint elders who can guide us through these difficult times? We would be most grateful. The Lord's family is growing so rapidly here, and as you well know, I have only been a believer myself for a few years. I need all the wisdom and advice you can supply. Thank you so much, and may God continue to bless you and keep you in His mighty arms. Yours in Christ, Brother Faisal. One by one, the four men rechecked their weapons, and one by one, they clicked off their safeties and eased into position. Dagger would take the first shots from a rock ledge using a high-power sniper rifle smuggled in through Gaza from Egypt during all the chaos. The rest would follow suit, then disappear into the hills, never to see one another again. Their radios suddenly crackled to life.
1 minute, said Dagger.
Mordecai reread the email. He felt a lump forming in his throat. He had never been in Saudi Arabia, even while serving in the Mossad. He had certainly never been to Mecca. What an amazing privilege it would be to preach the gospel there and strengthen the new followers of Christ. But when would he have the time? His schedule was already packed with speaking opportunities for the better part of the next year. Still, he would pray about it, and perhaps the Lord of the harvest would make a way. Mordecai's phone rang.
Now!
Dagger shouted into his radio. He took careful aim at the oncoming vehicle and pulled the trigger. His snipers immediately opened fire as well, blowing out the tires and riddling the doors with armor-piercing rounds. The car swerved violently. It veered into oncoming traffic, then came back again into its own lane, barely missing a tractor-trailer, as the shooting continued without pause. The windshield exploded. Mordecai ducked below the seat as the cell phone, still ringing, fell to the floor. His driver abruptly slumped forward. He'd been hit in the face and chest multiple times. The car swerved violently. They were headed for the guardrail and a 30-foot embankment. Mordecai reached over the front seat and tried to grab the wheel, but more machine gun fire now erupted from both sides of the road. It was a classic ambush, and for the first time in his life, Mordecai was caught utterly unprepared. Shattered glass flew all around him. Armor-piercing rounds penetrated the thick metal doors of his government-issue Volvo. He felt one rip through his arm, another ripped into the small of his back, and Mordecai cried out in pain. He felt the car crash through the twisted metal of the guardrail and plunge through the air, and for one brief moment, all was silent. No gunfire, no pain, just the horrifying realization that he was about to die, and then the sudden, unexpected joy that he was about to meet his Savior face to face. Mordecai never saw his attackers run for the hills. He never heard his car smash on the rocks below. He did not feel the force of the explosion or the searing, roaring flames consuming his flesh. He felt nothing, and heard only the echo of his wife's name as he drifted into darkness. Chapter 12. Monday, January 12th, 9:17 p.m., Babylon, Iraq. Al-Hassani retired to his suite. There, in the sprawling executive conference room adjacent to his almost equally spacious office on the 60th floor, overlooking the city of Babylon, which seemed to be rising like a phoenix from the ashes, the Iraqi president met privately with a dozen of his foreign guests over hot tea and sweet cakes.
"Mr. President, with all due respect, you have caught us all completely off guard,"
an Iranian CEO began when Al-Hassani opened the small meeting to questions.
"If I understand you correctly, you are essentially proposing that we give up our sovereignty and turn over our oil assets to you."
Al-Hassani paused a moment and scanned the other faces.
"Is that how you all see this, as a power grab?"
"On the contrary," said one of the few Saudi princes who had survived the near destruction of his country, "I believe you have been quite generous. You are proposing that we band together and maximize our economic and political clout, rather than remain divided and thus defeated. I think it makes great sense."
"I agree,"
said the son of the Kuwaiti oil minister, who had lost his entire extended family.
"Under the circumstances, it is the most hopeful news I have heard since this nightmare began."
The Iranian businessman could not believe what he was hearing.
"After all the Iraqis have done to your countries and to mine, how can you both sit there and say that with straight faces?" he demanded. "How can you be so naive? Can you not see what is going on here?"
"How dare you lecture me about Iraqi history?" said the young Kuwaiti man, his face turning red. "Don't let your passions blind you to the truth, my friend. The rape of our countries was not committed by Mustafa al-Hassani. It was the act of a single madman, and President al-Hassani is not Saddam Hussein. He is not about to invade my country or yours or fire Scud missiles into Saudi Arabia."
"He won't have to," the man from Isfahan shouted back as he jumped to his feet. "You'd gladly hand over your children on a silver platter."
"Enough,"
demanded Syria's former finance minister, who had been on vacation in Switzerland when the devastation occurred.
"Enough. This is exactly our problem. We are in the midst of a terrible crisis. We must make decisions very quickly or have them made for us, and we haven't the luxury of feuding among ourselves. Look around you. Have you noticed that even with oil at over $200 a barrel, our treasuries are all but empty? Have you not seen that OPEC essentially lies in ruins? And while we bicker over trivialities, our real enemy is rapidly becoming a global superpower. If we do not join forces and get our oil and gas industries back online, we will be ceding the entire playing field to the true and ultimate enemy of our people. Wake up, brothers. Medexco now controls the flow of oil to the world and has suddenly become the wealthiest company on earth. President al-Hassani is not the enemy. Iraq is not the enemy. The Jews are our real enemy."
The man from Isfahan sat down. The Syrian, an elderly man in his late 70s, asked al-Hassani if he could make a few more points.
"By all means," said the Iraqi president, privately wondering if Khalid Tariq, his chief political adviser, had coached this man in advance. "You are most kind, Your Excellency," said the Syrian. "My brothers, please, consider what the Europeans have done. They fought two world wars. They massacred tens of millions of their neighbors. 50 years ago, no one in their right mind could ever have imagined the emergence of the European Union. Had someone predicted the rise of a common market, a common currency, a central government in Brussels, a unified foreign policy, or any of the rest of it, he would have been committed to an insane asylum."
He pulled a single euro coin from his pocket and tossed it into the center of the enormous conference table.
"But there it is. The euro is crushing the dollar, the yen, and every other currency in the world. Don't you see it? It's a symbol that nothing is impossible if men of goodwill come together and unite under one banner for one cause. Open your eyes, my brothers. Europe is rising. She is triumphing. Why? Because she has unified. She is competing with the Americans, and she's winning, not divided, but together. We are witnessing the rebirth of the Roman Empire, and if we are not careful, we will be eaten alive."
The Syrian paused and looked around the room. "Which leaves us where?" he asked. "Divided, confused, bickering, feuding, and thus consigned to the ash heap of history? Is that what you want for your children and your children's children? Are you really so blind, so young, and so foolish as to miss the fact that what President al-Hassani has just laid out for us is not only a brilliant vision of what our future could be, it is, in fact, our only hope."
"Ken, it's Marcia Kirkpatrick. Sorry to bother you at home."
"No problem," Ken Costello lied. He was just back from a marathon few days at the White House and now coming down with a fever. "What's up?"
"I know you and Tracy are close to Eli Mordecai,"
Kirkpatrick said. "Sure," said Costello. "We just saw him Saturday at John and Aaron's wedding. Why?"
"Well,"
she said,
"I'm afraid I have some bad news."
A different Iranian CEO rose to speak. He was 33 and had been educated in the U.S. "I must say I agree with my brother from Damascus. Together, we could be a very powerful force, and it is not as though we have a lot of options on our own. The fact is, we need to raise reconstruction capital from somewhere, and President al-Hassani is right. We can either join forces with him, or we can beg on our knees from our competitors, the Americans and the Europeans. I say we work together. We could create a new OPEC, a force the rest of the world would have to fear and respect. But that said, Mr. President, we must have certain guarantees." Every eye turned to al-Hassani.
"Guarantees?"
the elderly Iraqi leader asked, a glint in his eyes. "Yes," said the young Iranian. "For one thing, everyone in this room must have real governing authority in our regions, the power to legislate, the power to tax, and so forth, like American governors and legislators have over their states."
"Of course," said al-Hassani. "It goes without question. I am proposing a republic, not a dictatorship."
"Good," said the Iranian. "And we would all need to share equally in the oil and gas profits, which will eventually become enormous."
"I don't see how this new republic could work any other way,"
al-Hassani agreed. "We would also need to create a national governing body," the Iranian continued, "a legislature with equal say in the decisions that are made over the currency, the tax laws, budgetary decisions, and so forth, like the American Senate."
"God help us," said al-Hassani to a round of laughter. "We will have to come up with something better than that."
"Fair enough," the Iranian conceded, "but that's not all. We will have to get the Egyptians and Jordanians involved, and the Moroccans too. We could do all this without them, but it would be far better with them."
"I have already dispatched my foreign minister to Cairo and Amman, and I will speak with the Moroccan king by phone in the morning."
"We will need a way to keep the Europeans and Americans from feeling threatened by any of this," warned the Syrian. Al-Hassani nodded.
"The EU foreign minister is coming to Babylon this week," he noted. "Salvador Lucente and I worked very closely together during the reconstruction of Iraq. We have a good working relationship. I expect some productive talks."
"Excellent," said the Iranian. "But there is one more thing."
"That's quite a shopping list already,"
al-Hassani quipped. His guest laughed. The Iranian smiled and continued. "I am looking for a promise."
"What kind of promise?"
asked al-Hassani. "I want your personal assurance that you will do everything in your power to stop the Jews from becoming a superpower."
"Isn't that in part what this whole discussion is about?" asked the Iraqi leader.
"No," said the Iranian. "It is not enough that we become a major economic and political force. You must prevent the Israelis from becoming an equal or greater force."
"And just how do you propose I do that?"
"To begin with, you must stop the Jews from building their temple." Al-Hassani looked around the room. Everyone was nodding. "Personally," said the Iranian, "I was never that religious, but the temple is a symbol. If the Jews rebuild it on the site of the Dome of the Rock, it will be a symbol of their power and our impotence."
Yes, said the Syrian, you must stop the Jews. The Jews must never be allowed back onto the Temple Mount, said another.
Let me remind you all that we haven't much time, Al-Hassani warned. The faster we unify into a single legal and political entity, the sooner we can request a seat on the UN Security Council. The sooner we can ask to become a member of the G8 Conference of Industrialized Countries. The sooner we can begin coordinating international relief efforts and maximizing the resources being offered to us. But if we hesitate or demand more than we can achieve, we could lose everything.
At that point, the Saudi prince stepped back into the fray.
I, for one, am ready to sign on to your plan right now, Your Excellency, he declared. But my brother from Iran is right. We must first have written guarantees on each of the points we've discussed here today, and your personal oath that the Jews will never be allowed to build their so-called temple in the holy city of Al-Quds.
Al-Hassani tried not to smile. Everything was going just as he had planned, and he knew something the others did not. He had already set in motion plans to stop the Jews in their tracks. Operation Black Box was well underway. Chapter 13. Monday, January 12th, 11:53 p.m., Ronda, Spain. The Bennetts finished a late dinner and strolled back to their hotel. It was almost midnight when they picked up their keys from the front desk and found a message from Ken Costello waiting for them, marked urgent. At first, Bennett was shocked simply by the presence of any message. Nobody was supposed to know where they were. Not the president and first lady, not even his mother. How could Ken have known? But then came the more important question. What could be so urgent as to interrupt them on their honeymoon?
Are you going to call him back?
Aaron asked as they got on the elevator.
We had a pact, remember? I know, but what if it's personal?
Said Aaron.
The only way Ken could have tracked us down is through the travel agency, and if he went to all that trouble, it must be important. What if something's wrong with your mom?
Bennett winced. His mother had a long history of heart trouble. At the wedding, friends had remarked that they hadn't seen her so relaxed and so peaceful in years, but Aaron was right. Anything was possible. So as soon as they got back to their room, he placed the call, while Aaron stepped into the bathroom to get ready for bed.
White House operator, may I help you?
Yeah, hi, this is John Bennett. I got a message that Ken...
Yes, Mr. Bennett, the president is expecting your call. Please hold and I will put you right through.
The president? This had to be a mistake. No, I... But the call had already gone through.
Situation room, Marsha Kirkpatrick.
It had been months since he had heard the National Security Advisor's voice. Marsha, it's John Bennett. I'm just trying to return Ken Costello's call, but...
I know, I am sitting here with the president. Ken's here too. So are Corsetti and Chuck Murray. Hold on. The president would like to speak with you first.
Before Bennett could react, McPherson was on the line. His voice was unusually subdued. Something was wrong.
John, I'm so sorry to interrupt your honeymoon, but I'm afraid it couldn't be helped.
I'm always happy to take a call from you, Mr. President.
John, it's Mordecai. He's been attacked.
Bennett couldn't breathe.
He's alive,
McPherson continued.
But probably not for long. The doctors believe it's only a matter of time. He's unconscious and barely hanging on. He's been shot at least a dozen times, and he's got third-degree burns over most of his body.
The president further explained that Mordecai was currently in emergency surgery and had been for the last few hours, but he was not expected to make it beyond the next few hours or days. Bennett couldn't believe what he was hearing. He didn't know how to respond.
John,
McPherson continued,
I don't have to tell you how involved Dr. Mordecai was as a back channel between the Israelis and the Palestinians. And as you know, under the radar, he's also been instrumental in building ties between the Israelis and the Iraqis. I've just gotten off the phone with Prime Minister Daron, and given all the uncertainty in the region right now, we both agree we need to be very careful not to allow the peace process, fragile as it is, to become derailed once again. That said, I've asked Ken to head to Israel immediately. He lifts off from Andrews Air Force Base within the hour. He'll be meeting with Prime Minister Daron and the new Palestinian leadership to take everyone's temperature and see if we can get final status talks moving forward again. If you'd like, I can have Ken pick you and Aaron up on the way and take you over there. I don't know if you can make it in time, but Well, it's up to you.
John was numb, but he thanked the president and accepted his gracious offer, then discussed the details with Ken. Just as he hung up, Aaron stepped out of the bathroom.
Is it your mom?
Aaron asked, seeing the pain in his eyes.
Is she okay?
She's fine, John said flatly. It wasn't that.
Then what?
He took her in his arms and held her tight. The next morning, they stood on the tarmac in Malaga. Costello stepped off the plane and embraced them both, then welcomed them back on board the same State Department Gulfstream V that had practically been their home during their years of shuttle diplomacy. What's the latest, Ken? Bennett asked as they lifted off. Costello hesitated.
Is he still alive? Asked Aaron.
Barely, Costello admitted. One of the bullets nearly severed his spinal cord. His doctors say his pelvis, right arm, and shoulder were shattered when his car went off the road, and he lost most of his blood before medical teams were able to get to him. To be honest, it's a miracle he made it through the night. The G5 touched down in Israel just after 4 p.m. local time. Costello and the Bennetts were met at the airport by Mossad chief Avi Zadok, who briefed them on the way to Hadassah Hospital in Jerusalem. We don't have many leads at the moment, Zadok said, but we have two working theories. The first is that the assassination attempt was an act of Muslim retribution for Dr. Mordecai's Ezekiel option memo. The second is that the attack could have been carried out by ultra-Orthodox Jews because of Dr. Mordecai's public claims about Jesus. Privately, Bennett wished there were evidence of Islamic extremism, but the truth was most of the region's Muslim community was mourning its dead and was shell-shocked by the extraordinary losses of its holiest sites. To him, it strained credibility to believe active cells of jihadists were capable of a carefully orchestrated attack so quickly after such devastation. More likely was the Jewish angle. Israeli outrage at Mordecai's betrayal was widespread among the Orthodox, heated and very public. Zadok showed them copies of written death threats, letters and emails that Mordecai had received in recent weeks. Even letters to the editor of major Israeli newspapers and callers on local radio shows had been warning Mordecai to watch his back. But then another wave of questions flooded Bennett's thoughts. How exactly was it possible to gun down a former Mossad chief inside Israel? True, Mordecai had given up his full taxpayer-financed security detail, but that was because the Mossad and Shin Bet had told him all the threats were just talk, that he really had nothing to fear. They had assured him that they would keep an eye on him. Zadok had personally chosen Mordecai's driver, a former Special Forces commando, and insisted he carry a sidearm and be with Mordecai at all times. How, then, could this have happened? Was it possible someone in Daron's inner circle wanted Mordecai dead? Chapter 14. Tuesday, January 13th, 5:17 p.m., Jerusalem, Israel. They found Mordecai under heavy sedation. According to his doctors, he was barely hanging on for his life. Bennett stared at his mentor through a glass window and silently pled with God to spare him. All of a sudden, a dozen security agents began taking up positions throughout the hallway. Bennett turned and looked at Aaron and then at the elevator, just as the door opened and the Prime Minister and two of his top aides stepped off.
It's good to see you both, David Daron said as he shook their hands. I'm sorry it's under such tragic circumstances. I want you to know I'll do everything I can to bring the monsters that did this to justice.
The Bennetts thanked the Prime Minister, as did Costello. It can't be doing you any political good to be here right now, Bennett acknowledged.
I don't care, said Daron. He was my friend, no matter how much we disagreed.
A doctor stepped into the hall. He was startled to see the Prime Minister, but addressed the Bennetts.
He just opened his eyes and asked for you, he said. But he doesn't have long. Did you bring a rabbi? A priest?
They had brought neither, and they didn't know any pastors in Israel.
I'm afraid we just got here from the airport, said Bennett.
Very well, said the doctor. You can have a few minutes with him. Follow me. The Bennetts entered the dimly lit ICU. They were immediately overwhelmed by the array of technology keeping their friend tethered to this world, and they were completely unprepared for the visual impact of Mordecai's broken body. His body was wrapped in gauze and bandages, as were his hands and feet,
But it was his charred and blistered face that made Bennett wince and, for a moment, look away. When he regained his composure, he looked back and saw casts on both of Mordecai's arms and legs and the tangled spaghetti of tubes and wires running in and out of his body. He scanned the various instruments, glowing and beeping in the dark. Mordecai's pulse and blood pressure were weak. Bennett gathered his strength and said, "Dr. Mordecai, it's John and Aaron." Slowly, the old man opened his eyes. A nurse gave him some ice chips, and Bennett noticed that his lips were about the only part of his face not severely burned, but they were chapped and cracked and covered with dried blood. It took a few moments, but in a raspy, faltering voice, Mordecai said his first words.
"I'm sorry."
Bennett noticed tears trickling down Aaron's cheeks. He fought back his own. Then Mordecai spoke again.
"I should have liked more time with you both."
Hey, don't talk like that," said Aaron. "We'll have plenty of time together. You still need to teach us how to make that curry of yours."
"Aaron sent an email to everyone on your listserv explaining what happened," Bennett added. "She posted it on your weblog as well. The response has been overwhelming. Millions are praying for you to recover, Dr. Mordecai, and I have no doubt you will." A faint smile began to form on the old man's lips, and crinkles formed around his bloodshot eyes.
"Jonathan, my son, you're a good boy, but you still have much to learn. I'm afraid I no longer have the privilege of being your teacher."
"Don't say that, Dr. Mordecai," Bennett pleaded, his voice wavering. "You're going to pull through this."
"No, my time has come. The Lord blessed me with a long and full life, but now I'm ready to meet my God face to face and to see my beautiful Yael once more. And I tell you both, I cannot think of anything I want more."
"But we need you here," said Bennett. "There's still so much we don't know, so much to be done."
"No, Jonathan,"
Mordecai said softly.
"This is your time. Make the most of it."
"What if I'm not ready?" Bennett asked. But Mordecai would have none of it.
"You are, and so is Aaron. But be on guard. A new evil is rising, more deadly than anything that has ever come before. I should have seen it coming, but I was so busy. I let my guard down, and then..."
There was a long pause. The old man's eyes were at half-mast. His strength was quickly fading.
"You both must promise me something," he said at last.
"Anything,"
said Aaron.
"You must find them."
"Who, Dr. Mordecai?"
"And stop them."
His hands were trembling. His pulse was becoming erratic. "Who, Dr. Mordecai?" Bennett pressed. "Who did this to you?"
Before
they what?" But Mordecai's eyes barely registered a response. He seemed to be drifting away, and there was another long, wrenching silence. Bennett saw tears streaming down Aaron's face as she covered her mouth to keep from being heard. Then he looked back at the man who had been his spiritual father and put his ear close to his mouth. He thought Mordecai said something like, "Start with..." But the next word was barely audible. "Break? Brock? Broke?" Mordecai was mumbling the same word over and over, but Bennett couldn't make sense of it. Then suddenly, it was as though Mordecai had gained a second wind, if only for a moment.
"I should have liked to have met my Lord in the clouds," he said finally.
Then he closed his eyes and breathed his last. The alarm on the heart monitor went off. Then the ventilator alarm went off as well. Mordecai was flatlining. Doctors and nurses burst into the room, forcing Bennett and Aaron to move aside. A nurse plunged a needle into Mordecai's chest. Another pulled electric shock paddles off the wall. A team of specialists raced through a series of emergency procedures, heroically battling to save a man most of them believed was a traitor. But it was too late. There was nothing they or anyone else could do. Mordecai's heart had stopped, and at last, he was home. Chapter 15. Tuesday, January 13th, 5:47 p.m., Jerusalem, Israel. The blood in Bennett's face began to drain away. The colors in the room faded. The room spun. His mouth was dry. A shiver shot through his body. An aching, throbbing pain coursed through his veins and through his soul. He felt the warmth of Aaron's hand, and for a moment at least, it seemed to anchor him back to reality. He blinked hard and turned to her as she began to sob, her body heaving, gasping for air amid her cries. He pulled her to him and wrapped his arms around her, and she buried her face in his chest and refused to let go. Soon his shirt was soaked through, but for some reason he couldn't join her. He couldn't cry. Not yet. It was all too sudden. He still didn't believe it was true. In the hall,